Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to LSE for today's online event, which forms part of the LSE Festival Power and Politics, taking place from Monday the 10th to Saturday the 15th of June 2024, and exploring how power and politics shape our world. Today's free lunchtime LSE skills session is hosted by LSE Online. Each day of Festival Week, we are inviting LSE experts to deliver bite-sized professional skills sessions on topics covering inclusion, people management, decision-making, sustainability, and data regulation. My name is Donald McKenzie, and I'm the Head of Programs at LSE Online, where LSE's world-leading education is made accessible to a global audience. We provide a comprehensive portfolio of online programs to equip you and your organization with the knowledge and skills to advance in an ever-changing world. Now to the main event. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Dr. Luke Schneider. He is an LSE Fellow in Decision Science at the LSE Department of Management. He has a PhD in Psychological and Behavioral Science from LSE. His research focus is on well-being enhancing interventions, work-life balance, and on decision-making processes. He teaches BSc, MSc, EMSc, and executive courses in strategic decision-making with Dr. Barbara Fasolo and Dr. Umar Taj, which includes an LSE online offering of the same name. I encourage you to check this out along with the rest of our online portfolio. More details will be provided at the end of this session. Today, Luke will be exploring how we make decisions and whether we can make more strategic choices by understanding the decision-making process. Just a couple of housekeeping items before we begin. For those social media users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. The event has been recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. Luke will present for approximately 35 to 40 minutes, and as usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to him in the Q&A feature. Please include your name and affiliation. So without further ado, it's over to you, Luke.
Hello, hello. Thank you for the very nice introduction. I'm just going to share my screen. And yes, hopefully you should be seeing the slides now. So today I'm going to be talking about how to make better decisions. I usually start my lectures with a quote, so I thought I would do the same today. This is just Napoleon giving you an extra reason to stick around for the next hour. As Donald mentioned, the idea is that for the next 30 to 40 minutes, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how to improve your decision-making process. Now, I want to start by saying that usually we teach this to people in a lot of different formats, but they range from 5 intensive days to 11 weeks of lectures and seminars, right? So this is the first time that I'm attempting to do it in less than an hour. So we'll see how it goes. What are we going to talk about today? We'll briefly start going through some background just to make sure that we're all on the same page regarding what kind of decisions we're talking about. And then I'll break down the three key ingredients of a decision, and I'll follow that up with three main tips to improve your decision making as soon as the talk ends. So let's start with some background then. And specifically, I do want to address a few misconceptions about what making better decisions actually means, right? Now, why do I start with this? Because I think there are a few commonly held beliefs that are actually a little bit harmful to the way that we approach decision making. The first of those is that making better decisions always means having better outcomes. Most of us, when evaluating the quality of our decisions, have this tendency to judge them based on their outcome. So if the outcome was positive, we will say that the decision was a good one. And if the outcome was negative, we'll say that the decision was bad. This is very natural, right? It happens all the time. If you're a sports fan and your favorite team just lost because a player missed their penalty, you might say it was a terrible decision to make them take the penalty, right? This is kind of instinctively where our mind goes. We associate the decision quality to the outcome. That being said, it can actually be very problematic because it overlooks the fact that a lot of big decisions are made in really uncertain environments, right? So there are a lot of factors influencing the decision that we just have no control over. In reality, we might make a good decision, but we could get unlucky and end up with a bad outcome, just like we could make a terrible decision, but get lucky and then have a good outcome, right? So if we judge the quality of our decision-making process based on the outcome, we might end up dismissing good processes or preserving bad ones based on luck. And we definitely want to avoid that, right? So of course, if we take 100 decisions that follow a good process, more of those will have a good outcome than if we look at 100 decisions that followed a bad process. But on a case-by-case basis, we should always factor in the uncertainty, right? Now, the second misconception is that there's a tendency from people to assume that making decisions is all about being rational, and that being rational means ignoring our emotions, right? This is equally harmful to the decision-making process in general, right? Because emotions are a really important aspect to consider when making big life decisions, right? It sounds pretty obvious, but say, for example, that you're deciding whether to change jobs, right? You're changing careers, or you're deciding to move to a different city or country. Well, in examples like this, how you feel about those things is going to be an important indicator of whether the options you are considering actually align with your objectives. Most of us care about happiness, about feeling good on a day-to-day basis, and ignoring our emotions might make it more likely that we will choose something that doesn't actually align with our preferences, right? So what we should do instead is we should understand how emotions provide helpful information and when they might be a source of bias, right? And then we will preserve the emotions when they are helpful, and we will try to adjust our decision-making process accordingly when they might be a source of bias. So that's the second misconception. The final misconception is that making better decisions is always about dedicating more resources to every decision. That is also not the case, right? So instead, it's going to be about recognizing which decisions require different amounts of resources and allocating those resources accordingly. If you're choosing where to get your coffee in the morning before work, you're probably better off spending as little time on this as possible, right? But if you're deciding on which house to buy, that will require a lot more thought. Yeah? So with this out of the way, instead, making better decisions is going to be first and foremost about applying a better decision-making process. And this is what all of our courses are about. Following a better decision-making process is what is going to maximize the likelihood of reaching a good outcome. And that is what we're aiming for. When we teach people that have a lot of work experience already and that are looking to bring what they learn back to their companies, we always tell them, you are the content experts, we are the process experts, right? So we can't teach you about how to make better decisions specifically in your industry, but we can teach you about a process that you will be able to apply to that industry and that will work better than most likely what you are using now. Secondly, making better decisions is about understanding what approach each decision needs. Right. So by learning how much time and effort to dedicate to each decision, and by understanding which parts of the framework are best suited to each specific case, that is when you will truly start becoming a better decision maker. And finally, making better decisions is about being aware of your objectives and your options. But we'll get back to that in a moment when we start talking about the key ingredients of a decision. Now, one point of clarification then, before moving on to those ingredients, our focus here is about strategic decisions. So these are important personal and professional decisions, right? So we don't care so much about the small day-to-day ones, might be important, but would be the subject of a different field altogether, right? Now, strategic decisions are ones that will necessarily involve trade-offs between conflicting objectives. So if you have one option that is strictly better than all the others, you're not making a strategic decision. They're also inherently dealing with uncertain futures, right? This uncertainty that I was talking about that may influence the outcome. They're decisions that we are making in context where there are a lot of factors that might be outside of our control. And part of making strategic decisions is about being able to assess the levels of that uncertainty. Next, strategic decisions are the ones that have big consequences on our personal lives or on the lives of other people, and that will be difficult or impossible to reverse. Essentially, they have high stakes, right? So for example, if I decide to move to Barcelona instead of staying in London, of course, I can change my mind once I'm in Barcelona and move back, but that will be very costly, right? Both in time and resources. Similarly, if I accept one job offer over the other, chances are that I will never be able to go back to the other offer once I've actually committed to the first one, right? So hopefully this gives you a good sense of what types of decisions we are actually focusing on today. And now let's move on to the actual ingredients of a decision. Now, the main ingredients of any decision are going to be options, objectives, and the information you use to compare them to one another. Now, I will say this is a little bit of a simplified perspective for the purpose of this talk, but essentially these are the main three overarching components that you will easily be able to grasp regardless of your level of pre-existing expertise, right? So I'll give you a very quick overview of each of these, and then we will start talking about tips to actually improve your decisions using those main three ingredients. So first, objectives. Essentially, your objectives are what you want to achieve with this decision. Now, this can mean a lot of things. So let's take an example. Let's say that I'm deciding what jobs to apply for or what job to take in the next stage of my career. There's a bunch of objectives that come to mind quite easily, right? So for example, I care about salary, about the company culture, about my work-life balance. I might care about career progression or the presence of mentors in the company or just having nice colleagues, right? All of these things are pretty obviously related to the decision at hand. That being said, for most strategic decisions, relevant objectives will actually cover many more aspects of life. So in the example of the job decision, even though the first things that come to mind are the objectives that are related to the features of the job, this is a decision that also impacts many other things like my commute, maybe my proximity to my friends, or my ability to carry on doing my hobby. So it might even involve things like moving to a different place, in which case I would have to consider objectives related to those things. The point is, even though we tend to frame our decisions as relating to just one aspect of our lives, our objectives are usually much more varied than that, right? As a result, we tend to only be aware of a small subset of those objectives. And we'll get back to this when discussing improvements. The second ingredient, options. Simply put, these are just the alternatives that you have to choose from, right? So for example, in the job decision, this would be, should I take job A or job B. Two small notes about options. Firstly, if you don't have clearly defined options yet, you're not dealing with a decision yet. Often, you might think of a decision as something like, what should I do in the next steps of my career? Or how should I structure my life to be happy in the next year? If these remain open questions, the way that I phrase them, then these are problems, and these are problems that don't have a solution yet, but they will only become decisions once you actually have identified some possible options to choose from. If you have options to choose from, the second thing to be wary of is that we tend to think as most of most decisions as binary, even though most of the time they aren't. This is because we make most of our decisions in our heads. Comparing one thing to another is still relatively manageable from a cognitive perspective. But as soon as you start trying to compare more than two things, say you have three or four or even five options, this becomes much, much more complicated to all keep in your head, right? So this means that we might artificially restrain our options to one or two, right? So one being, should I do this or not? And two being, should I take job A or B? And we'll restrain our options, even though we'll see that most of the time, having more options is going to be beneficial to your decision process and to the quality of your eventual decision. This is also why one general tip that I always give anyone that comes through our courses is to write things down. When you make a strategic decision, write down your options, write down your objectives, because as soon as this this information is outside of you, it becomes much easier to process it cognitively and to dedicate your cognitive resources to making the process as good as it can be. Again, we'll get back to that in a moment. The third one, finally, is information. Essentially, this is the data that allows you to compare your options to one another and check how well each of them satisfies your objectives. Again, I'll have two small notes here. One, as mentioned before, in strategic decisions, no option is ever perfect. So there will be trade-offs. You will have to make trade-offs. Now, since these trade-offs are informed by the information that you have or that you're gathering, that makes this information all the more important. When you think about how an option compares to an objective, you need to make sure that the information that you have is accurate. And one of the problems that a lot of people might have is that even though we make judgments about our options all the time, we rarely actually check these judgments for accuracy, right? Now, this is a problem because if we do use inaccurate information to compare our options, we might end up making a decision that doesn't actually reflect our true preferences. You now have a broad sense of the three main ingredients of the decision, and I've hinted at some improvements already. So let's spend the remaining time on actually discussing those improvements, right? I've included one for each of the main decision ingredients, and I've tried to make them as easy to implement as possible. Obviously, in a talk like this, we're never going to be able to fully break down the process, but my hope is that you'll be able to start using these things immediately after the talk if you need to. Maybe not during, just wait 35 more minutes. So the first tip, start with objectives. The reason why this is the first tip is because most of the time, we naturally start our decision-making process by identifying options. A lot of the times, we will not even really be thinking about the fact that we have a decision to make until options explicitly present themselves to us. And this isn't necessarily a problem. Keep in mind that your options are only relevant insofar as they allow you to satisfy your objectives, So if you take the options as a starting point, chances are that these options will not be very well aligned with your objective. So by starting with your objectives, you allow yourself the flexibility to then create options that will satisfy those objectives better. This is what we call value-focused thinking, and there's a lot of research on this. It's an idea, a decision-making approach that started in the early 90s, and today it's still the most widespread and probably most widely accepted approach to making decisions in the field of judgments and decision making. Concretely, how do you actually start identifying your objectives? The first step is extremely simple, right? Nothing crazy so far. You just start by writing down all the objectives you can think about. Make a list. Try to consider as many aspects of your life that have already occurred to you. Also keeping in mind whatever we've already discussed, right? The fact that a lot of decisions might not always relate exclusively to the aspect of your life that they naturally relate to. Now, once you have this list, the second step is the part that most people never really get to. The second thing you should do is find a master list from an external source and use that list to add any relevant objectives from there to your list. So there's many places where you can find master lists. We do this exercise with most of our students in our courses. And sometimes that master list will come from people that have faced similar decisions in the past, or it could be a simple Google search, right? If your decision is common enough, there's a good chance that there are already lists of objectives out there online, and you should definitely make use of that. So once you find one of those, you go through that list, you select any objectives that are also relevant to your decision, and you add that to the list that you've made in step one. Now, this will result in a final list that is hopefully much longer than the one that you got in step one. And you should then take a little bit of time to rank your objectives in order of importance. This serves a few purposes, but mainly it's meant for you to better understand what your priorities are in this decision. I'll spend a moment more to explain to you why do we actually use master lists from an external source. The main reason for this is because there's good evidence that shows that people find many more objectives using an external tool like this than they are able to identify by themselves. So the most famous study, which I've included in the references that are on the last slide of this presentation, shows that MBA graduates that are looking for their next job placements tend to identify on average 6 objectives by themselves. And once they are given an additional master list to choose from, they select an additional 15 to 16 objectives from that list. So this master list massively expands your scope. It draws attention to all the aspects of the decision that you may not have thought about yet. Not only that, but there's also evidence that shows us that we tend to forget some of the most important objectives that we have, right? So within those same studies, 80% of people overlook at least one of their top 3 objectives without that external input. Even though it might naturally feel to you that you know what you care about, you know what your objectives are, you should always take the time to look for that external source, because it might surprise you with things you just hadn't considered. To recap, tip number one, write down your objectives, find external input to expand on them so that you have a nice long list at the end, and make sure that you write all of them down. Now, obviously, there'll be many more than 4, but for the purposes of illustration, I'll stick to 4 in this slide, because this will come back in a little bit. Tip number two, expand your options, especially if you did start the decision-making process with some options in mind, which I imagine some of you might be in that situation at the moment, then chances are that these options are rarely the ones that will best satisfy your objectives, especially once you've already identified the objectives that you have that are most important to you. Taking some time to give yourself more options will significantly improve the chances that your decision will have a good outcome. Here, remember, this might be a familiar phrase to some of you, or maybe it's just familiar to me because of what I study, but the decision can only be as good as the best option you have. Giving yourself more options will almost always be beneficial for your strategic decisions.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Now, concretely, how should we expand options? The first thing to do is assess how well your original options satisfy your objectives. You'll most likely find that these options perform relatively poorly on some of the objectives that you have, especially objectives that you might have identified using this external source. So this is your first opportunity to expand and actually improve the pool of options that you're considering. Now, the interesting thing is, in our classes, one thing that often comes out of the process when some of our students implement it is that thinking of hybrid options tends to perform really well. This would be think about the main strength of each option and then try to create an option that brings these together. This is why we call it hybrid. Usually it's some sort of compromise between the two options that you originally considered. So I'll give you an example. Earlier this year, one of my students was working on an important personal decision. She was figuring out whether she should remain pescatarian, which she had been since she was a child, or whether she should start eating meat again. And she had a few conflicting objectives. Staying pescatarian, for example, scored much higher on remaining healthy. Starting to eat meat again scored much higher on being able to freely go out with friends to whatever restaurant they choose and not feeling like a burden on them for having to cater to her diet. Initially, it seemed like this student might have to sacrifice one of these two objectives because they seemed almost completely incompatible with each other. But at some point in the process, she and her group realized that there was another option, which was to remain pescatarian in her private day-to-day life, but allow herself to eat meat when going out with friends. This seems really obvious in hindsight, right? When I break it down like this, it's like, well, duh, why didn't you think about that immediately? But in that actual process following the group, it was a true revelation to her. She really hadn't considered this as a possibility at all. And after the entire process was done, this is the option that she ended up going for because it actually satisfied the majority of her objectives much better than either of those two original options. So oftentimes, some form of compromise between the original options you have is probably feasible and might actually satisfy your objectives much better than either of those two options do. Now, finally, obviously, you also want to search for entirely new alternatives based on your list of objectives. You can see how tip number one and two are related, right? The most effective way is to start with objectives and then use that to inform the way you come up with your options. To summarize these two, you start with your list of objectives and then you expand your options. There's no fixed rule on how many options you should have, but in the many strategic decisions that we've seen over the years, it seems that anywhere between 4 and 6 might be the sweet spot. Any less, and you're likely limiting yourself too much, but any more, and you might actually become overwhelmed by the number of options that you have to compare to each other. Now, seeing this slide, hopefully you're also starting to see what I'm trying to do here, right? I'm creating a table with objectives as rows and options as columns. And the aim will be to use this table to more easily compare the options to one another in order to figure out which one aligns best with your objectives. There's only one thing missing in here, which is the actual data to fill it in, which leads us to tip number three, identify relevant information. Now, I've already kind of hinted at this, but a lot of the judgments we make about our options might be biased or prone to error. And this is going to be true regardless of your level of expertise, regardless of how many decisions you've made in the past, right? So experts might be prone to different biases, or they might be affected by them to different degrees, but they are by no means immune to them. Thankfully, most of these biases can be mitigated by simply understanding how and where to search for relevant information. In most of our courses, this is actually what we spend most time on. We teach our students about the most common biases, how to spot them in the judgments that they're making, and then how to correct them. Because we know that if we want any hope for our decision-making process to be as good as it can be, we need to make sure that the information we use is accurate. Now, obviously, teaching you about these biases and mitigation techniques wouldn't make sense in such a short time. So I'll focus on the basic steps that should allow you to check the accuracy of as much of your information as possible without having to go through biases. So, how to search for relevant information. First, it's about identifying what information you will need for each objective. So let's take an example again. If I'm deciding whether to stay in London or move to Barcelona, and one of my objectives is to live in a city with a warmer climate, the information I will need is weather reports from both cities in the past years, right? To see which one of the two tends to have a climate that suits me better. Now, for other objectives, it may not be so clear what the information is or where to find it, but whenever you can, you should try to prioritize objective data from reliable sources. In the event that objective data is not available, what you want to do then is identify a relevant reference group. What I mean by this is identify people that have made similar decisions in the past and that are similar to you in terms of their main objectives, and ask them about how they made their decision and what their experiences of the outcome might have been if they've already experienced that outcome. Ideally, you want to find several people like that to make sure that you have enough data points to make the comparison between your options as representative as it can be. So going back to the table, you have all of your main objectives, you have your options, and you now fill it in with whatever data you find. In general, here we also recommend trying to quantify the data in a way that you'll be able to add up the scores for each option and directly compare these scores to one another. So you might take a standard scale of, say, 1 to 5, score each option in each objective. And by the end of that, you might be able to figure out which option satisfies your objectives best. You may also want to add weights to your objectives to reflect their relative importance, but this also depends on how quantitative of a thinker you are. Importantly, the results from this table are not the absolute objective truth, right? A lot of this process is iterative. You'll have to make subjective calls along the process, and you'll have to learn by doing. So sometimes it takes several iterations of this table before it properly reflects the way you care about your objectives and the way your options actually compare to each other. right? The key is to remain flexible and to recognize that every decision is unique. And you might therefore require more emphasis on different parts of the process, depending on what that decision looks like. What I can tell you is that the more you do this, the easier and more natural it becomes. Those were the main three tips. And as you saw, they're obviously related to each other. So I would say always try to follow these in the order that I presented them. And I do have, before we open it up to questions, some complementary tips. The first one being fairly obvious, take the time to define the decision problem. This essentially means figure out, try to reflect on what you are actually trying to do with this decision. If your decision appears to be a career-related decision, think about whether this is actually about your career or whether this is about your home life or your relationships more broadly, because depending on the actual focus, it might completely change what the objectives are, how they rank, and what the options are that you find in your decision. Next, I've already talked about this, write things down. I really like this sentence that I put on the slides. We're very good at remembering lots of things, but we are terrible at remembering everything, right? If you keep everything in your head, chances are that you are going to overlook some major aspects of the decision. And I already alluded to this when talking about options, but writing things down simply already makes it much easier to expand on your options. You'll be able to compare 3, 4, 5 options to each other in a way that you couldn't possibly do if everything just stayed in your head. And finally, break things down. So smaller, simpler steps are much more effective than trying to consider everything at once. You'll have seen that in this talk, this is already what I've started doing. I broke it down between ingredients, and I gave you clear steps to follow, where while you consider objectives, don't worry about the options yet. Once you consider the options, don't worry about the information that you're going to use to compare them to each other yet. All of these things come one at a time. Once you've figured out step one, step two becomes easier, more accessible, right? And again, this is what we try to do in most of our courses. So we have an actual framework that has 5 steps, which are much more elaborate than what we've seen in this half an hour. And if you are interested in learning more about this, I would recommend either an online course, or we have some executive courses that teach this in this condensed 5-day intensive format in which we can cover much, much more. But I can also tell you that these are actually things that I now use to make my own decisions. And since I've learned about this, I can also tell you that my decision making has substantially improved. So hopefully it can do the same for you. And that's all I have. So I have some references here on the slides, but I'll now end screen sharing and then open it up to questions.
Expertly timed there, Luke. Thanks so much for that genuinely fascinating stuff. So we will now open the floor to questions from the audience. If you haven't already, please type short questions into the Q&A box and we will try to answer as many as we possibly can. Please include your name and affiliation with these two. All right, Luke, we've got quite a few to get us started here. So let me just find that list just now. So we're going to kick off with a question from Malvina. And Malvina's question is, if your decision is a life-changing one, how do you ensure that the emotions you refer to do not derail you in your decision-making process?
I like that question. That's a very good question. The answer is might be a little bit disappointing. This really depends on you as a person and on the nature of the decision. So we recognize that depending on the nature of the decision and how you react to things, you're going to be much more prone to emotional reactions or not. So One of the things that we usually talk about in our courses is identifying process goals early on. What we mean by process goals is essentially not the objectives of the specific decision, but the things you care about in making sure that the decision process is as good as it can possibly be. One of those process goals that we commonly come across is minimizing emotional strain. So if you recognize that a decision is particularly emotionally challenging, then my recommendation would be to try to create an environment within which you can approach the process as calmly as possible. Sometimes it helps to try to put yourself in different scenarios. So over the years, many of our decision makers that faced very emotional decisions might have used, say, a third party case study to try to be a little bit more objective, right? So rather than making their decision directly, they were put in a scenario where they were advising their best friend on the same decision. And this doesn't fully dismiss your emotions because you're still being considerate about the objectives, the emotional objectives that you have, but it might actually prevent you from being emotional about that process, which is the part that you want to avoid. And actually, some of our decision makers have felt it was very, very helpful to try to put themselves in that scenario. If you have friends that may help you with the decision, asking those friends to create that scenario for you might actually be very impactful as well.
Thanks, Blue. Next question is from Violet. And the question is, how do we make decisions when we do not have accurate information or if accurate information is unacceptable? And it's just underneath, Violet has, in most cases, we don't have accurate information.
So this is interesting. I'm curious about what you mean by if information is unacceptable. Was that because this might actually be alluding to one of the biases that is very common, right? So one of the things that we teach early on in our course is confirmation bias. This idea that we do look at search for information selectively to cater to the beliefs we already hold. And this isn't just about the way that we search for information. It's also about the way that we often fully dismiss information that conflicts with our actual beliefs. Sorry. And in cases where you have confirmation bias, the best way to go around this is engaging yourself in self-reflection and trying to make sure that you consider opposite perspectives from the one that are available. Now, on the question of what to do when information is not available, this is tricky, right? One of the things that you need to consider in strategic decisions is the levels of uncertainty that you are dealing with. And in very highly uncertain environments, unfortunately, there's really not much you can do. You can still follow the process the best you can, but you are always going to have to keep in mind that you will be limited in the way that you have control over the outcome. And I think in cases like that, the best way is to simply accept those limitations and think about potential contingency plans if things were to go wrong. This is another thing that we do with all of our courses. We put people in scenarios where they consider everything that could go wrong in a decision, and we ask them to come up with contingency plans and actually build their options with those contingency plans in mind, right? So this is an exercise that often actually makes people change their options so that they are more uncertainty proof, quote unquote, right? That being said, the less information you have, the more difficult that is going to be as well.
Great. Thank you for that, Luke. The next one I think we can all empathise with, this is from Peter John. Peter John asks, how do you avoid dwelling on feelings of regret after making decisions that don't result in what you wanted?
I like this because this is a question that is very relevant to a lot of our students at the LSE, because a lot of students at the LSE are what we call maximizers. So people that are spending as much time and effort as possible to make sure that they get everything right. And as a result of that, because you're so emotionally invested in getting that decision perfect, whenever something doesn't work out, you might be much more prone to regret. The best thing that I can say to this is actually by becoming more aware of your decision-making process, I think this is very, very helpful to start regretting your decisions less, right? So if you know that you have followed the best possible decision-making process, then even if something doesn't work out, when you look back on that decision, you can still find comfort in the fact that you did the best you could with the tools that you had, right? What I find is before I started applying this process, I did regret more of my decisions because I wasn't nearly as confident about the fact that I was using the right process. And since I've started using this process, I have actually made decisions that haven't worked out. But most of the time, I have enough certainty about the fact that my process was good, that this gives me more reassurance and makes me less prone to regret. I will caveat that by saying that the degree to which everyone experiences regret is also in part personality driven. And so if you experience a lot of regret to begin with, this might be more difficult for you to reach as a state of mind than for others. But hopefully that process focus will actually help already.
That makes sense. Thanks, Luke. The next one we've got is from Yukiko, I hope I pronounced that correctly. And the question is, when recommending that we expand our options, how do you account for biases, heuristics like choice overload and the decoy effect?
Yes, this is a very good question. So choice overload, for those who are not familiar, is this idea that especially in low stakes decisions, when presented with a very large amount of options, we might actually revert to not making a decision at all rather than choosing, right? This is actually part of the reason why I spent a little bit of time in the talk defining what we mean by strategic decisions, right? Because in strategic decisions, you're rarely going to have 20 or 30 options, which by nature will limit the potential for choice overload. The second thing I will say is going back to the discussion of options, there is that sweet spot, right? If you can find anywhere between 4 and 6 options, most likely you will be able to make meaningful comparisons between them in a way that follows a good decision-making process. What we have seen in the past is that, yes, once you go beyond that 7, 8, 9 options, often you see substantial diminishing marginal returns to including more options. So I would recommend be mindful of that sweet spot. You're definitely correct in your intuition that you shouldn't add more options just for the sake of it. And then to the second part of the question about the decoy effect is not necessarily a problem in this particular situation, because sometimes including an option that is completely dominated by others might still give you more clarity in terms of what your objectives are and how the other options compare to each other. This is something that we had a good example of in our undergrads this year, where the decision maker was choosing what major they should go for in their studies. And they had 5 or 6 choices. And they actually included an option which was dropping out of their studies. And obviously they were never going to do that, but actually scoring that option on in that table that I presented gave them some insights about what they cared about, and it allowed them to reframe some of their objectives. So yeah, I hope that mostly answers the question.
Yeah, I think it does. Next question is from Khaled, and this is around, I think, a particular scenario. So Khaled has asked, what to do when fleshing out an alternative situation would take a large amount of external help research factors? And so you're left with one concrete option and the alternatives are unclear. What would your approach to that scenario be like?
That's a very interesting question. Yes, I think that in a lot of cases, our ability to seek external input or help is one of the big potential limiting factors of our decisions. Now, obviously, there might be specific examples where you are actually left with only one options and option and a lot of unclear ones. But what I will say is we've now come across over 200 strategic decisions in our courses, and it has never been the case that people could not expand options with the resources that they had. That being said, often we do have decision makers that come into the course claiming that it's impossible, right? My recommendation here would be try going through the process and actually, in this case, it might involve going through one of the courses that we have so that the process is more extensive, right? And try to see how this makes you think about the options. If you still run into the limitations of only having that one option and only very unclear things next to it, then unfortunately, you may not really be dealing with a strategic decision as we were saying, right? Because you would have to be able to identify those options to actually have a choice. If you just have the one path forward, then it might be that a decision will actually manifest further down the line.
Nate, thank you. 200 strategic decisions is a lot of decisions.
Yeah, it's been a few years.
All right, next one. So you mentioned, so this question is from Mari, and it relates to, I think you made reference to looking for master lists in your presentation, Luke. So the question is, where would you look for a master list of common biases and thought distortions? Could you recommend one?
Yes. So actually, if you're looking for lists of biases, there's a lot out there. But the one that I like most, because it is, I think, most friendly to the public while also providing you robust academic definitions with academic sources, would you need one, is the one by the Decision Lab. So the Decision Lab is kind of a behavioral consultancy. And on their website, they just have a repository that is free to access for anyone that contains a lot of biases, and that generally covers basically every common bias that you might encounter in your decision-making process. This is the list that I usually recommend to my students when I tell them that we don't cover all biases in our courses, and if they find something else, that's where they should look. If you're talking about master lists of objectives, then this will be much more context specific, but especially for career related decisions, there will be lists available, and I would just recommend Googling, because this really just depends on the decision. But yeah, the Decision Lab, and on their website, they will have the bias repository.
Sounds like a great resource. I'm going to finish off with this one because I can identify with, I'm sure many others will too. So this question is from Mohammed, and Mohammed asks, how does one avoid decision paralysis?
This is I so my brother should be should actually listen to this. I don't think he is, because we play a lot of board games, and God, it is so frustrating because he never knows how to decide what to do on his turn. This again is a question that is tricky, because it goes back to personality to some extent. But here I would refer you back to one of the complementary tips that I mentioned all the way at the end. I think the easiest way to overcome decision paralysis is breaking things down, right? A lot of the times, the paralysis comes from feeling overwhelmed. It's about having the sense that there's so many things to consider and not enough mind space, not enough time to consider everything. So rather than thinking of the decision as one big thing, think of it as a bunch of small incremental steps. And each of these individual steps should be easily manageable in terms of cognitive load and in terms of time. So yes, I think breaking things down here is probably the most effective way of trying to tackle that.
Hey, thanks, big help that for me as well. Unfortunately, that is us just about out of time. So I just want to finish by saying a big thanks to you, Luke, for a great presentation and discussion, which I hope everybody else enjoyed too. Thanks to the audience for joining us today and contributing to this. There are lots more exciting events coming up this week at the LSE Festival, so do check out the programme at lse.ac.uk/festival. Tomorrow's Festival Skills session is with Dr. Orla Linsky and Professor Andrew Murray on how does data regulation work for our digital society. We hope to see you there. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.